It is time now to step into the Wayback Machine. That is Hanson, of course, and their 1997 smash hit, Mbop. They started a band in 1992, and later this fall, they are celebrating the group's 21st birthday. To honor the occasion, they will be marketing a beer called Mhops. Hanson also has a new album that comes out this week. It is called Anthem. The brothers Hanson join us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the program, guys.
Thank you.
Isaac, hello.
This is Taylor.
And this is Zach.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much.
So happy to talk with you. So when you hear that version of yourselves, when you listen to Mbop and what you were doing way back in the day, what do you think about that sound?
I
think we're proud of it. You know, the interesting thing about our band is we did get so lucky to have success young, but we always used to tell people, you know, just think of us as old guys with high voices. because when we started, we always saw ourselves at the very beginning of a long career in music, and we had the great fortune to have actual commercial success at the beginning. That song represents our story. It's a garage band, you know, that loved soul music and doo-wop and classic American rock and roll, and it's a song we wrote. It's a song that Zach is one of the three writers, which makes him the youngest Grammy-nominated songwriter ever. He was nominated at 11.
That is amazing. Zach, is that crazy when you think back on that? I mean, 11 is young, but you were ripping it up on those drums.
Yeah, 11 is young. You know, it's just something we always wanted to do, and to be honest, we just never thought that much about it. I think I find myself thinking a lot more about age now just because you're like, wow, I'm an adult. Like I'm supposed to have it together now. I'm almost 28. What's going on here?
Yeah.
Isaac, you're the eldest. The oldest and wisest.
Yeah, I like to think so, but I think actually at the end of the day, Zach may be the wisest.
I don't know what I owe him later.
How has your musicality changed over those years?
Well, as a band, there's no question that we have, you know, evolved. No question. I mean, as a band, I think as a unit, we're inevitably tighter, if nothing else, just because of 16 years of practicing together. But I think all of it still was coming from the same place, no matter what, whether I was 16 or whether I'm, you know, 32. It is really a question of kind of coming from that same love of soul music, early rock and roll, R&B, and songwriters. No matter what, I will always hope for that day when I look around and can say, oh yeah, I wrote a song that touched me emotionally the way that a song like She's Got Away by Billy Joel did. I just want to write a great lyric and write a great song, and everything else is icing on the cake.
Well, I would love to play something off the new album. Let's play the track called Get the Girl Back. I mean, it feels like a little bit of an echo of Uptown Girl by Billy Joel. It has that same kind of energy. Is that a compliment?
It's a great compliment for us. I mean, we love Billy Joel. We love great American songwriters and classic rock and roll, like we said. But the other thing about us making records is we're all three writers and we're all three players. And when you hear this album, the album's called Anthem, because it's full of anthems of different kinds. Anthems for your street corner, you know, anthems for your bad day, anthems for your epic fight.
For getting the girl back.
To get the girl back. and it really paints a picture of our sort of lifelong love affair with a lot of American rock and roll and songwriters and soul music.
Let's listen to a different track from the album. There are these bright poppy tunes on it, but there are also some songs with a little more edge, a little more grit. Let's listen to a bit of You Can't Stop Us. So I understand that there was a certain amount of tension around this recording session. Is that true?
This album is an album that I think we had to really look inside and ask ourselves what was next. We came to the making of this record, and in the very beginning we had a strong plan of how we were going to record it, and essentially realized that we couldn't make the record because we were kind of getting onto each other constantly and really had to step back and say, okay, year 20, why are we doing this? What are we doing it for? Is everybody in? There was just a sense of intensity and size and scale to almost everything, and I think what we all came away with was essentially that we wanted to be bold. You know, if this is going to be, you know, album number one of the next 20 years, the record needed to be anthemic, to hold no punches.
There was, you know, a lot of tension amongst the brothers, you know, and we had to kind of figure out ways to resolve that, and one of them was musically resolving that.
That, like, sits in the pocket so well.
Doesn't it sound a little bit like it's trying too hard?
We made a documentary, actually, about the making of the record. It's called Remade in America. But we put Remade at the front of it because it was about remaking, recommitting, rethinking.
I know. Get the riff out of the way. Make it a chord.
When you start as kids, you know, you're brothers and you grow up and you're in the same bed and you kick the other guy's, you know, bunk bed and you're like, hey, you want to go practice? You know, that doesn't work the same way 20 years in.
No, it doesn't.
So what were some of the compromises that had to be made? I mean, if there was tension and... You know, you don't have to get into it. I know what happens between brothers. Sometimes you don't want to air this.
How many hours do you have?
But you know, did something have to give, and what was it?
I think the main thing is it was just sort of this assumption that you could go into the studio and, oh, yeah, we'll write a song tomorrow. And we'll write another one. 12 days later, we'll have a record, and we'll, you know, go record it. And what we found was it just takes more than that. And when you start to take it for granted, due to exhaustion and repetition, It just doesn't work. You know, it's like you've got to go get the oil change in your car. I think everybody had to stop and remember why we make records to actually feel that fire.
I'd like to ask you about Oklahoma, if I may. Mm-hmm. That's home for you. You're from Tulsa.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's obviously been an incredibly difficult time for folks in that part of the country. Mm-hmm. I imagine the storms, the devastation there, this has been tough for you all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that we are probably hits closest to home is that community and more is a place where when we very first started out, we performed in those schools. Mm. And those communities were really supportive of this band. So the desire to do more, to watch it, to help it rebuild, we're going to be continually a part of that because that's our home.
We should mention you are starting this microbrew, this beer, and all proceed sales from the merchandise of that beer will go to the Red Cross to aid tornado relief efforts.
Yes.
Part of your story is also the fact that each of you, I understand, met your wives at your own concerts?
You know, people meet at work, and we were at work, and we were all traveling. It's great because we got, you know, we sort of got to travel the world and see, you know, a lot of different potential partners. And,
well, how does this go down? You're like on stage? You really like you see someone in the front?
Well, as cheesy as it is, my
Isaac
story
is the only one that actually has a story that involves, hey, that girl out, you know, you in the audience.
Mine is thoroughly as elaborate as one might think it could be.
It's exactly that.
Can you give me the short version?
Well, the short version is basically I see my wife about five people in. It was a standing room thing. It wasn't a seated venue. So she was standing about five or six people back. Her and her friend are really tall. My wife's like 5'9", and her friend is like 5'10". So they were standing above everybody so I could see them. And I thought she was really cute. And so I was like, wow, that girl's really cute. So I sang a couple songs directly at her to get her attention, threw a guitar pick at her, hit her, and told her to
get
something. You did not throw a guitar pick at her.
I threw a guitar pick.
You should stop mentioning that. Yeah.
No, I did.
It's like a cat call. You should throw it.
I had to make sure she knew I was talking to her.
Does she still have the guitar pick?
Yeah, she does.
Oh.
Yeah, she does.
Well, before we say goodbye, I'd love to play one more track. This is my hunch that the cut called Tonight is the one that's going to bring out everyone's lighters in the stadium shows because it kind of rocks. Let's listen to this. This is Tonight. Just I'm dreaming. Isaac Taylor and Zach together, they are Hanson. Their new album is called Anthem. They joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks so much, you three. It's been so fun.
Thanks for having us.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. Writer Rebecca Solnit begins her new memoir with 100 pounds of apricots. And before the book is finished, she's explored her tempestuous relationship with her mother, who's facing Alzheimer's. She's been a writer in residence in Iceland, and she's drawn threads that connect the stories of Scheherazade and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Allowing her imagination and intelligence to wander have always been a feature of Rebecca Solnit's many books. Her latest is called The Faraway Nearby. It's an exploration of empathy and the role of storytelling, and it opens with a question.
What's your story? It's all in the telling. Stories are compasses in architecture. We navigate by them. We build our sanctuaries and our prisons out of them. And to be without a story is to be lost in the vastness of a world that spreads in all directions like Arctic tundra or sea ice. To love someone is to put yourself in their place, we say, which is to put yourself in their story or figure out how to tell yourself their story.
Author Rebecca Solnit reading from her new book, The Faraway Nearby. Her starting place was that 100 pounds of apricots delivered from a tree her failing and forgetful mother could no longer tend. She says that mountain of stone fruit arranged in her bedroom was to her like a task from a fairy tale.
Where you have to spin a whole room full of straw into gold on pain of death. But they also felt like a fairy tale gift because it was such an amazing superabundance. I didn't recall ever having had an apricot from that tree, so it was amazing to suddenly have a mountain of them. I took them out of the boxes that my brother had brought them over in and thought I was going to just feel rich and admire this pile of abundance. But every time I looked at it, there were a few more going bad, and so it became a pile of anxiety. I was always looking to see what was going wrong.
This book, The Faraway Nearby, isn't one of those memoirs where the mother is venerated, because the two of you are very different people, and it's a complicated relationship. When she starts being forgetful, she doesn't call your three brothers, she calls you. She says, well, you're the girl, you're at home all day, you're not doing anything. Did she understand you as a writer?
In some ways she did. I think when she talked about me to other people, she represented a version I liked. When she talked about me to me, there was a kind of denying that I existed in a way. And, so I was just a mirror for what she needed or expected. But I have to say we were a great deal alike, and that made it all so much more interesting.
What was the genesis of this book as you are thinking about her? You write that one of the things you wanted to explore was the nature of empathy.
Yeah, well, the book is very much about storytelling and empathy and the way those two things relate. Because we often talk about empathy as an emotional virtue, but it's also an imaginative art. Before I can empathize with you, you have to become real to me. I have to listen to you. I have to imagine what it's like to be you with your illness or your situation or your aspirations or whatever it is. If you don't have empathy, other people might not exist for you, or you just can't imagine. We really need to be fully human to imagine being every other kind of person, and it extends you, it expands you. And that sort of expanding and contracting, projecting and numbing self is a lot of what this book was about for me.
At the end of this book, you and friends have prepared these apricots as bottles and jars of jam. You've given a lot of those away, and you've really come to a peaceful understanding of your mother. Can you talk a little bit about that? Did she ever see any of these jars of apricot jam that came from her tree?
I spent lots of time taking her out to eat the things she loved, you know, coconut ice cream and things like that. But somehow it never occurred to me to bring her the apricots. But the really interesting thing with my mother is that so much of her wrath at me wasn't really me. It was narratives about what a daughter should be, about what feminine beauty should be, about what she lacked and she thought I had. Over the passage of time through this disease that's Alzheimer's, she just forgot all the stories. And it was really remarkable for me because really for the first time that I could remember, I'd walk into a room and she'd be just thrilled to see me. The stories were really what had come between us. You know, it was like a wall fell down and we were really able to contact each other in a way that we hadn't before and to be with each other. And when it was a really interesting passage of time, a really elated time for her in many ways, everything was incomparable. Every piece of cake was the most delicious piece of cake. Every flower was the most beautiful flower. She had a really wonderful time because she lost terrible things as well as the things that we all want to have as part of our ability to function. And then, of course, the disease continued to progress and she lost more and more capacity and perception and awareness. But there was this remarkable period where she just was so enthused about me and so effervescent that was just enchanting and enchanted.
And Rebecca, you explore that relationship in this tapestry of stories that transport us from Iceland to the ancient Tang Dynasty in China, so many places, more than we can talk about here, but it's a rich and imaginative journey. Rebecca Solnit's new book, The Faraway Nearby, has just come out. Rebecca, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.